exciting innovations happening around the county and beyond. Hear from industry experts on the challenges and technological advances in business today, as well as courses and networking opportunities. That's In Business every Thursday from 6 to 7 here on Radio Kerry. Proudly sponsored by Orbitus, which is providing the Kerry business community with integrated tax, legal and HR services from the heart of Tralee. Orbitus.ie.
Atlantic Oils Ardfert would like to wish all their customers a peaceful Christmas and a prosperous New Year. Thank you for your custom throughout the year.
A wide range of topics, an even wider range of views. Talk about on Radio Kerry.
Now, you're very welcome back. I was just reading there before I came on air a lovely column by Sinead Ryan in today's Irish Independent. Sinead is a regular contributor who writes a regular column in the Irish Independent. But she's just talking about the fact that all through most of her adult life, or practically all of her adult life, she's had a huge crowd around the table for Christmas Day. And she talks about the pressure and the stress and having to cook for so many people, etc., etc. And she's saying that this year, for the first time, there's only going to be five of them. Now, she doesn't go into any great detail as to why she has gone from a big group down to five, but I'm assuming that it's the case of adult children spending Christmas with their in-laws and stuff like that. But she's just saying that there's just going to be five of them and she's really looking forward to it. And you know what? That's just the way it is. It's just life. It's the circle of life. There will be people who will be spending their first Christmas without a partner who passed away during the year. There will be people spending a first Christmas as parents with a new baby. People who have Christmas as first Christmas as grandparents, people who are spending their first Christmas as a married person but not in their family home where they grew up, all those changing scenarios. But you know what, if you just have somebody that you love and care about with you for Christmas Day, isn't that worth anything? And that's the important thing. And you know, even though we miss people who are far away, I know an awful lot of young people from Kerry in Australia at the moment, but isn't it wonderful to have technology and video calls and all that type of thing, which makes the world a much smaller place. Now, loads of you are getting in touch already about the etiquette of when you open presents. And one person says, in our house, Deirdre, I always place the presents under the tree until 1 minute past midnight, and then it's Christmas Day. Well, I'll tell you something for nothing. I wouldn't be awake at a minute past midnight. Certainly not tonight, anyway, because it's been an early start for me this week. So I'll be long since tucked up in my pajamas, I'd say, by then. But thank you for that. But I would also like if people would answer our West Kerry listener who is opining this afternoon. Is it rude to open a Christmas present in front of the person who gives it to you? We want your thoughts on that. 083 300 3300.
Medical Matters on Talk About, brought to you in association with the Bon Secours Hospital Tralee, celebrating 200 years of the Bon Secours mission.
Now, Eamon has very kindly agreed to take time out from his busy schedule to come in. He's like Santa, he's so busy.
With the grandchildren.
You're so busy with the grandchildren, yeah. So Santa's back in your house again.
Oh, yeah, very big time.
With a vengeance.
With a vengeance, exactly, yeah.
It's magic isn't it?
It is, absolutely. It is great. And the other newer invention, which would be the elves.
The elves, all on the shelf.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah. Yeah, I won't say what I want to say about the elf on the shelf.
I know. There is a whole mythology around them as well.
Yeah. Let's just say that the elf disappeared from our house 5 or 6 years ago, and I was never so glad to see the back of
anything.
Imagine,
get away from you. I wonder why.
Anyway, Eamon, welcome. Thank you for coming in. It's always great to see you in person. And of course, the last Medical Matters slot of 2025. We might begin by talking about the elephant in the room, really, this flu that's doing
still
the rounds. And I have not first-hand experience of it myself. But
I
have friends who've really had it knocked out of it, floored.
Yeah, and indeed, a couple of children with it as well. I had a little child into me. I was in the practice earlier in the week, and there was a 4 or 5 year old, and they had tested positive for influenza earlier in the week, and you know, they get quite sick and unwell with it. I suppose one of the things we forget is that while it's a horrible dose for anybody, people at the extremes of life, the very young, the very old, and pregnant women are particularly at risk from influenza. It can cause serious, serious problems. Interestingly, I see that the Health Protection Surveillance Centre, the HPSC, are saying that while numbers overall seems to be stabilising, unfortunately, we're still seeing an increasing number of people over 65 being admitted to hospital or contracting influenza, which is a pity. It's just a horrible loss and nothing you can do about it. Once you get it, you just have to sort of plough through it. Interestingly, there is a medication that can be used to try to mitigate the effects of the influenza. The generic name for it is oseltamivir. I see it has gone in short supply. Just got a notification. I'm still on the SouthDoc mailing list and I saw a notification just to say that's in short supply at the moment. Probably not surprising because it's been used fairly widely. Now, what the oseltamivir does is it absolutely definitely does not protect you from influenza. It doesn't stop you getting getting the consequence of influenza, but they're not as severe, I think is probably the best way to put it. So it's an evidence of how much of it there is in circulation.
There's been articles in the papers in the last few days, Eamon, about why this flu is slightly different from other flus in previous years.
Yeah, there's the so-called antigenic shift. I'm not sure which strain. It's an A strain as far as I know, but which of the A strains? That's the issue with nearly all viral infections, but influenza, it mutates, it changes from year to year. The difficulty is that we develop an immunity to one of the strains of influenza. That then goes out of circulation and a new strain comes into circulation to which we have less immunity. And then after the winter, we've had immunity. So the next year on, we're not as susceptible to that particular virus, but then it changes again. So there's a kind of an arms race that's going on there all the time between the viruses and our immune system.
Yeah, okay. Do you think people are getting the message vis-a-vis vaccination?
Well, slowly but surely our stock of vaccine is disappearing, which I'm delighted. As late as yesterday, we were still vaccinating people. I know we certainly still have vaccine in the surgery, and I've no doubt there's lots of practices around, and I know the pharmacists would still have it in stock. It does take about 2 weeks for the vaccine to kick in. That's the only thing you need to be aware of. But it's still worth people's while right up to now to get the vaccine if they can.
And I know you've said this already, but I just think it's worth repeating it, Eamon. For people who have the vaccine, it doesn't mean you won't get it, but
no.
If you get it, it won't be as severe.
Yeah. Well, not wishing to be morbid about it, but if you get the flu vaccine, the likelihood of your dying as a result of influenza is much less.
Okay.
It doesn't mean to say you can't die because of influenza, although it tends to be along with a lot of other things, but it certainly mitigates against the worst of the impact of the virus, and best case scenario is that you won't actually get the virus or you won't get influenza at all.
Yeah, okay, very good. Eamon, we might crack on with a couple of questions.
Absolutely.
And we'll start with this one. It's from a 50-year-old lady and... Actually, yes, it is a woman. She's just 50. For the last 2 days, she has been passing blood clots after a bowel movement. She's looking for advice.
Oh dear, I'm sorry to hear that. One way or the other, she needs to get this thing checked out. Now, the difficulty is that, of course, pretty well from now. In fact, I know for a fact, SouthDoc are on duty from now until next Monday morning. Your own GPs will be off for the Christmas period. And of course, the Wednesday, all the Thursday, all the Friday, and of course, Saturday and Sunday are the weekend. And the surgeries will be open again on Monday. If this continues to be a problem, particularly if there's a lot of bleeding, I think you should present either to SouthDoc. If you have to go to casualty, but we know casualty is absolutely hectic at the moment. Any bleeding from any part is a concern. Bleeding from the back passage is a concern also. Generally speaking, if you're looking at bright red blood, it implies something that's coming from near to the back passage. Now, it's possible that it's something as benign as a dose of bad dose of hemorrhoids.
Or piles, as they're commonly known.
Exactly. And that could be the reason. The difficulty is that if you're getting clots, it means you're passing enough blood to actually form a clot. So there are some fairly major blood vessel that's actually after tearing there. It could still be a dose of piles, but the concern is that there's something else going on. One way or the other, or at the earliest possible opportunity, you should get this checked out.
Yeah, okay. There's been a change in the criteria for bowel screening. They've lowered the age. It was 60 upwards it's younger.
I think it's 58 at this age, yeah. So there is what they call a FIT test. There's a screening test, very simple test, which checks for the presence of break down products. Now, it's not blood that it detects. It's not a blood test. It doesn't detect blood in the bowel motions, but it does look for if there is something growing on the inside of the bowel, if it sheds stuff that breaks down, that turns up in the bowel motion. That's what the test is doing. Mr. Murray in the General Hospital, who runs a screening program there, was saying that for every 1,000 patients they screen, they expect to have about 50 people who have a positive bowel test or FIT test, the screening test, that of those, maybe 10 of them turn out to have something going on after colonoscopy, and of them maybe one or two actually turn out to have a bowel cancer or something like that. Those are the kind of figures. But the FIT test is a screening test, and they've extended the interval to bring in younger and older people who might be suffering from or in the early stages of bowel cancer.
Yeah, and again, no harm to remind people if you have been called for
it. Oh, absolutely, do it. It's a very simple, straightforward test, and you don't have to go anywhere. If you're one of the 950 people for whom the test is negative, happy days, you're grand for another while. If you're one of the 50 people, as they say in the letter that goes out, doesn't mean to say you necessarily have a bowel cancer, but they will organise further investigations. They'll do a thing called a colonoscopy for you.
Yeah, a listener's been in touch, just coming back to the flu again, and says that they have what to them seems like all the flu symptoms, extremely weak, pains everywhere, but they're vomiting as well.
Yeah.
Doesn't say whether it's a man or a woman. Yeah.
That could well be part of it. Now, unfortunately, norovirus is in circulation as well. The dreaded winter vomiting bug is in circulation as well. And I've seen one or two utterly miserable individuals who have had both influenza and norovirus at the same time. That's a horrible dose. The big problem with the vomiting on top of everything else is just the risk of dehydration is there. If you're taking medication, there are certain medications, you should know about this yourself, that you shouldn't take when you're vomiting, don't take them. Otherwise, it's sips of fluids. If it continues to be a problem, you could talk to your local pharmacist. They could get you fixed up for something to help settle down your tummy a bit. Obviously, if it continues to be a problem, if you're feeling very unwell, you should contact the medical services.
Yeah, exactly. Vomiting isn't necessarily a feature of this flu,
not,
is it?
Not necessarily, no. It's more the aches and pains tends to be the thing. But I have had a number of people who have had vomiting as well.
Yeah, exactly. A listener says, I'm at home with the flu, Eamon. I feel absolutely rotten. Any advice about how to speed up the recovery process?
None whatsoever. Ride it out. Now, the difficulty is that, unfortunately, it's worthwhile bearing in mind that what happens is that when you get exposed to the virus, and if your immune system isn't able to fight off the virus initially, what will happen is the virus will pretty well go into every single cell in your body, and it'll hijack the mechanisms that produce protein in the cells to replicate themselves. That's the whole thing about the virus, is that it hijacks your own body's mechanisms, and it diverts energy away from you into the production of the of itself. It replicates itself, and then you cough and sneeze and that goes out of the body. Eventually your immune system will kick in, will kill off the virus, and eventually you recoup the energy. But in truth, there's no way that I know of. I mean, I think the main thing is keep yourself comfortable. Paracetamol, ibuprofen, one or the other, plus any other remedies you can get from a chemist to try and keep yourself comfortable. Try and keep yourself reasonably hydrated. Don't worry about the eating. There's not a one of us that can't do without food for a week without any difficulty whatsoever. But fluids will have problems within 24 or 48 hours. So keep sipping fluids. And then after that, just wait for the thing to recover. And the old cliche, it takes a week if you're, you know, good, and it takes 7 days if you're not good. What I mean to say is that it's going to take the same length of time. And to be aware of the fact that it's probably going to take another couple of days after that again just to get the energy back. So it really knocks the socks out of you when you do get it.
And that's the problem, is that none of us have the patience.
No.
We want to be better immediately.
I think that's going to shorten it.
Slightly controversial question for you now, Eamon. A listener asks, should hospital workers take the flu vaccine?
Yeah.
Bit of a no-brainer, really.
It is, yeah. And I know this has been an issue, and I'm aware that the health services have been concerned about the poor uptake, and let's name it what it is, the poor uptake of flu vaccine among healthcare workers. Okay. We're not a totalitarian state, and nobody must take the vaccine. People have the choice to whether they take the vaccine or not. But given the fact that people who are working in healthcare environments are going to be naturally exposed to all the viruses and so on, it seems a bit of a no-brainer to me. All I can say is that as soon as the vaccine became available at the beginning of October, I had it for myself.
Yeah, I got the vaccine as well, and I made sure everyone in our house got it as well.
Absolutely.
Yes, a couple of people wanted to know if you would repeat what you said people should take before the flu.
There isn't anything you can take before the flu. If somebody develops influenza after the flu, after you develop influenza, and you really need to have influenza because the medication, I want to use the generic name, I don't use the trade name, it's oseltamivir is the name of the medication. Oseltamivir is something that reduces the rate, as far as I know, it reduces the rate at which the virus replicates itself, so it mitigates the effect. If you, it does not prevent you getting influenza. Absolutely, categorically will not protect you from getting influenza. And oseltamivir, although now it's been out a couple of years at this stage, I know there were concerns initially that we had to make sure that people's renal function was good, that there wasn't a problem because it's excreted through the kidneys. And there were just these little red flags around it, pink flags, let's call them, about the safety. Now, it is a safe medication to take, and there are lots of people who can absolutely safely take it. There's a handful of people who shouldn't take it. But the point I'm driving at is that this medication does not prevent you getting influenza. If you get influenza, then if you get this particular medication, it might help mitigate or reduce the severity of it, but it doesn't protect you from getting it.
And is there, you know, wasn't there a particular drug that was supposed to be very good for when you had, when people had COVID? Was it Tamoxifen or something? Or
no? Yeah, Tamoxifen. Again, the Tamoxifen was one. Again, and there were other antivirals there as well too. Again, the particular way these things are formulated, this particular one is specifically formulated for the influenza virus, where there are the ones formulated for COVID.
Okay, so Tamoxifen, yeah.
Yeah, different, there are different
remedies
medications.
For different viruses. Viruses,
that's it.
So to come back to what you said originally, so paracetamol, ibuprofen,
plenty of rest, fluids, and just take it handy. And basically, you're going to be out of circulation for a week, no matter what way you're slicing and dice it.
Yeah, don't go near anyone.
Absolutely not.
All right, Eamon, it's stark, really, but it has to be done. Okay, it's just gone a 2:15. Just to let you know, we still have some room for more questions. So if you'd like to send in a query for Eamon, phone it through to Brenda on 066 712 3666, or indeed text or WhatsApp us on 083 300 3300.
Medical Matters on Talk About, brought to you in association with the Bon Secours Hospital Tralee, celebrating 200 years of the Bon Secours mission.
Now, Eamon, we'll crack on with some questions. This next one is from an 89-year-old male. He says he has a touch of sciatica down the right-hand side of his leg.
Yeah.
His doctor gave him a strong injection for his back and medication to take, but he's wondering, is this enough?
Okay, so the answer is, I'm not trying to be facetious or smart about this one, you'll know in time. Now, what I mean to say by that is that in the vast majority of cases with sciatica, where sciatica is due to pressure being put on the sciatic nerve, which is a nerve that comes out of the lower part of the back and then down the outside of the leg and then ends up around the little toe, that pressure that's put on the nerve comes and goes, and when it comes you get the pain, and when it goes you don't get the pain. A lot of the time what you're doing is you're trying to alleviate the discomfort, and even our pain specialist colleagues, that's what they're doing, is they give injections to try to deaden the nerve, to stop pain signals getting up to the brain. Because most of the time what happens is that the thing that's putting the pressure on the nerve, usually a bit of a disc or maybe a bit of bone, what'll happen is the nerve will actually cut a track, or there'll be a track will develop, a channel, if you like, through which the nerve can pass, takes the pressure off the nerve and the pain goes away. I've certainly had the experience of one or two people who were waiting for procedures to be carried out, and by the time they got called for the procedure, the pain was completely gone. Now, that doesn't always be the case. The purpose of the exercise is try to leave the person's discomfort until such time as the thing sorts itself out, and that hopefully it happens sooner rather than later.
All right. Next question is from a caller. I don't know it is a woman. She has a chronic cough, but she says nothing is coming up. Is there anything she can do to heal it?
Okay, so we're going to see a lot of people using, and I'm going to encourage people, if necessary, talk to their own GPs. There are a number of combination inhalers that have an inhaled corticosteroid, a steroid, and what's called a bronchodilator. Now, I've said it a couple of times, and I think it's worthwhile repeating. The days of using the blue inhaler are over. People should not be using the blue inhaler. There's this replacement inhaler. There's a number of different brands of them, but they have the anti-inflammatory, which is what's missing from the blue inhaler, along with the other ingredient. The thing is that you get this irritation, you get this inflammation, and not uncommonly, after influenza, people will have this tickly cough going on for weeks afterwards. And certainly I knew back in the day when we were treating COVID, we were using a lot of these anti-inflammatory inhalers, and they are very effective at relieving the symptoms. They just take away the inflammation that's there. but not the blue inhaler on its own, because that's not going to sort you out.
All right. Okay. A listener says, my brother got sepsis last week and is still in hospital. Could Eamon speak a little bit about sepsis?
Yeah.
The causes of it, when to call the doctor, when to call an ambulance, etc.
Yeah. Okay. Fair enough. Yeah. So there are 1,000 different reasons why people can get sepsis, strychlepsis. Strictly speaking, what sepsis means, or septicemia to give it its full title, it's where you get a bacterial infection in your bloodstream. Now, there are a couple of situations where it can particularly happen. If you get an actual kidney infection, people say they've got a kidney infection when they mean they've got a dose of cystitis or a bladder infection. If you get an actual kidney infection, if you get a pneumonia, you're more likely to get sepsis, which the old-fashioned term for it was blood poisoning. All right, that's what it is. So it's where you get a bacterial infection in your bloodstream and you can get quite unwell with it. The problem with sepsis is that it can cause damage to various bodily organs. Again, the kidney can be one. And so people can suffer from what's called kidney failure during these things. So I think the main thing to look at is the individual. There are a couple of sort of warning signs. What you're looking for is where the person, adults or children, if they start getting very quiet on you, if they are very cold, but particularly hands and feet, if they're very cold. And you're looking for a thing called capillary refill. So what that is, if you press on the person's finger, and normally when you press on somebody's finger and you take your hand away, you'll see the blood shooting back into the fingertip. If you press on the person's fingertip and the blood doesn't seem to be coming back, that can be an indication that they're shut down. Depending on how unwell they are, if they are very unwell, it may very well be a case of dialing 112 or 999 and calling for the ambulance, because sepsis can be fatal if not treated in time.
Yeah, there's an awful lot more talk about sepsis in recent years, actually, than there used to be.
Part of it is that there's an awareness raising going on, and this is part of it.
Yeah. A listener says, I have a cyst in my ovary. The consultant said he would remove both ovaries. I have a history of cancer in the family, but not ovarian cancer.
Yeah.
Is it right to take the ovaries and not just the cyst?
Yeah, it depends. And I suppose to a certain extent, it does depend on the family history. And there are a number of families. There is a thing called Lynch syndrome. And what it is, it's families who are genetically predisposed to constellations of cancers. So bowel, breast, ovary. And not infrequently, if there's a strong family history of cancer in these other organs, if you have any sort of problems with the ovaries as a precaution, you remove the ovaries. Now, oophorectomy, to give it a full title, but removing the ovaries is a big deal depending on the woman's age. If she's premenopausal, she's going to have an instant menopause. If she's postmenopausal, it might not have the same impact, but at the same time, it is fairly invasive surgery. It's something that you need to talk to your the consultant about in this case, because they need to go through the rationale for you. To be fair, most surgeons are fairly risk averse and they're not going to subject you to what's not insignificant surgery without very good reason. So they need to do a further job of discussing with you why and what are the pros and cons of you having the ovaries removed.
Very good. A listener asks, does Eamon know anything about neuropathic atrophy?
Atrophy. Okay.
This person is just diagnosed with it.
Okay. So strictly, the words neuropathic and atrophy in themselves are not necessarily a diagnosis, and I suspect there's something else going on here. Neuropathy is at the state where something is interfering with nerve supplies to various parts of the body, and atrophy is where there is wasting of certain tissues. So you can have atrophy of muscles, which means that the muscles have wasted for some reason. Something is interfering with the nerve supply to some part of the body. A classic example is you've got this so-called diabetic neuropathy or alcoholic neuropathy, where people either have a disease, they have a disease in both cases, which damages the nerve supply to the legs, and the person can end up with very numb legs to the point where they can injure themselves and not even feel it. I presume that as part of that, you can sometimes get this atrophy or wasting of the muscles. All our muscles require constant signalling from our brain to, if you like, keep them active. And if the signalling disappears, you will get an atrophy of the muscles, or wasting of the muscles as a consequence. So there are some underlying condition that's leading this. The neuropathy and the atrophy are descriptions of what happens as a consequence.
A 75-year-old female caller is wondering, is there any way she can receive the bowel screening without a colonoscopy?
The answer is that the screening test is just that. It's a screening test. Colonoscopy is not the screening test. The screening test is where a sample of bowel motion is sent away to the laboratory for analysis. And if the result of that is negative, then you don't need to have a colonoscopy. Generally, if the result is positive, it is suggested you have a colonoscopy. A good colonoscopy, and I would say good because there is the bowel, the preparation of the bowel for colonoscopy is a bit of a tedious task that takes 24 hours beforehand. But there still is nothing better than the surgeon's eyes to examine the inside of the bowel to tell you what's actually going on. And of course, when you have the colonoscopy, if there's any areas of the bowel that look suspicious, the surgeon can take samples of tissues, can take biopsies of the tissues that look suspicious for further analysis.
I wonder too, Eamon, you know, just from reading that question, do some people wrongly believe that bowel screening involves a colonoscopy? And is that why a lot of people don't go for it?
The actual bowel screening test itself is literally you take a sample of stool. There's a kit that comes, it helps you, there's a mechanism that you can take a sample of stool, that's sent away to the laboratory for analysis, and that's it. That's the bowel screening. Colonoscopy is a diagnostic procedure which is carried out afterwards if somebody has a positive bowel screening test. Now, there are other reasons that people can have colonoscopy as well. If you remember our lady who's talked to us earlier on about the bleeding, which we hope is from piles, but if there's anything of any suggestion of anything else going, she'd probably need to have colonoscopy done, or at least a proctoscopy done, to see what the source of the bleeding is.
Now this next male caller is 72, has heartburn-like symptoms coming and going for over a year. He had a chest X-ray, an endoscopy, a CT scan and an ultrasound. Everything came back clear. Anything related to his heart was also ruled out. He says, any advice, welcome.
You can get this kind of jargon for this kind of functional dyspepsia. And basically, there are some individuals who do seem to be prone to indigestion. There are a number of the older treatments. I'm thinking of stuff called sucralfate, another one called bismuth, which would have been around before the Pentiums and the Nexiums and all those kind of things. And they can be used in this situation. In this kind of difficult situation, the person who is best qualified to advise you about that would be a gastroenterologist or a bowel specialist.
Very good. Next up, a caller is on antibiotics for a cough and is also taking an inhaler for the wheeze.
Yeah.
Would Eamon recommend anything else to leave it?
Not particularly. I mean, again, go back to the point I made. It's really important that the inhaler you're taking has the anti-inflammatory medication in it. So there are medications like budesonide and beclomethasone. These are particular inhaled steroid molecules. I think it's worth bearing in mind that when you inhale the steroid into your lungs, you're taking a tiny fraction of the dose you'll get from a single steroid tablet. And generally, unless you're really harsing the inhaler, it doesn't have any impact on the rest of your body. It's just going directly into your lungs where it is needed. But that's generally the most effective treatment.
Yeah, this next one, this listener says, they're asking on behalf of a man who is 70 and is on continuous antibiotics for urinary tract infections every week, but I'm not sure what the question is.
That's an unusual situation. It's also a very difficult situation. The difficulty is that as we get older, if you like, because of changes to the body for men, but more so for women, bacteria can more easily get into the bladder and cause inflammation. You sometimes see the situation, even though the bacteriologists don't like it, where the person is given continuous antibiotics over a long period of time. The reason I say the bacteriologists don't like it is because the bacteria very rapidly adapt to these antibiotics, and you get to the point where the antibiotics stop working. And I've certainly in the past have had one or two patients where when they did get urinary tract infections, unfortunately the only thing that got them sorted was to be admitted to hospital for intravenous antibiotics for just a simple cystitis, which is a horrible dose. So there are ways and means of getting around that. And again, the people who would be most qualified to answer that would be the urologist, or urology colleagues in the general and the bonds, who would be able to advise you about what other methods could be used. There are things, for example, by changing the acidity of the urine, not massively, but changing the acidity of the urine, that can change the bacteria or the growth of bacteria in the bladder, and that can help relieve the situation. The other thing that might be an issue is that this person person may well have a catheter in an indwelling catheter tube in the bladder, which unfortunately will act as a source of infection as well. And there are things you can do for that also. If I go back to Edward Jenner, antiseptics still work where antibiotics don't. So the old-fashioned antiseptics, the problem is we can't take antiseptics into our system, but there are a few places, there are antiseptic washes for the bladder that can be useful at killing off bacteria that don't involve antibiotics.
All right. I'm just going to manage to fit two more in, Eamon, if that's okay. I know
we're over time. No bother.
A listener says, are blood tests accurate for diagnosing celiac disease? I did have breads with celiac prior to tests, but have no other symptoms.
Yep. Okay.
The blood test showed I do have celiac.
Yeah. If your blood test for if you go on a completely gluten-free diet, the problem with that is that when you do the blood test, you won't have the substance in your bloodstream that indicates that you're allergic. The substance that indicates your allergy is present only exists while you're taking bread or other gluten-containing foods. So if you're taking a normal gluten-containing diet, like just regular bread, and that's what we encourage people to do the blood test, and if the blood test is positive, that's it. Now, as a follow-up, generally what will happen is people will have a thing called a gastroscopy. They'll have somebody look at the lining of the stomach, particularly the first part of the bowel beyond the stomach, which is the part that's affected by the celiac disease, and that, if you like, is the gold standard, definitive, beyond any shadow of doubt, test for celiac disease. But the blood tests are very accurate. Are they 100% accurate? No, but they're very accurate. There are one or two situations under which they might not be positive, but in the vast majority of cases, they are.
Now, this final question actually encompasses what I was going to ask you anyway, and it's from a listener, and she says, to paraphrase what she says, is it normal to feel a bit down on days like today? I'm very stressed, even though I have plenty. I can't get into the spirit of things.
Yeah.
I'm 75. I'm not cooking today, but I sometimes feel like I have to think of everything.
Yeah.
Maybe I think I'm 30 in my head. And she says, I don't want to spoil anything for anybody.
I know. You nearly get emotional about that. The thing about it is that, unfortunately, there is so much invested. And I say unfortunately, there's so much invested in the Christmas and the Christmas Day, and everybody wants it to be absolutely perfect. And the reality is there's nothing in life that's absolutely perfect. Imperfection is a part and parcel of everyday living. And it's being able to accept the imperfection that, look, if the day isn't absolutely perfect, what of it? It's more important to be with the family, with the friends, to just enjoy yourself, chillax.
Yeah, I think so as well. Yeah, and you know, it is normal to feel down, I suppose when you think about it, there's all this hype about one day.
Oh yeah.
And then if you're not bouncing off the ceiling with a smile on your face, you're wondering, are you missing out?
No. Yeah. No, absolutely not. No, I think it's, okay, we were just talking off air about the fact that the Irish Christmas holiday is a joy to behold because it goes on for so long.
It goes on for about 3 weeks, yeah.
And I think people should enter into the spirit of that. And it's a midwinter festival. Of course, there's a religious aspect to it, and that's hugely important as well. But it's a midwinter feast, which is where it was originally came from. And just take time out, spending time with the family. And it's not just the Christmas Day, it's the whole of this time.
Yeah, and if you don't see them tomorrow, you'll see them some other day over
exactly.
Christmas.
That's exactly it, yeah.
Well, look, Eamon, on that positive note, thank you for everything during the year. I don't know what we would do without you and talk about. The listeners would be in an awful state anyway if they didn't have you for Common Sense every Wednesday. Have a lovely Christmas to yourself and herself and the grandkids.
Exactly, and they're all around, exactly.
And I hope Santa comes to Farn 4. I'm sure he will.
He'll find his way there along with everywhere else.
He will. And we'll see you the first week after Christmas. And with that, we will take a break. And we have a lovely bit of poetry for you with a Christmassy feel after these.